is lecture 33. It's going to be a shorter lecture than usual today because we're having student evaluations.
Mr. Bumstead.
This is answers, yes. Other people who didn't get answer sheets? Wayne, you didn't get an answer sheet?
These here for others to work on. Okay, so today we begin chapter 7, called Application to Quantum Field Theory. Quantum field theory is a huge subject. It is only available for me to talk in about 5 or 6 lectures about quantum field theory, so I will not be able to barely scratch the surface. So what I'm going to try to give you is a kind of a sketch. And if you haven't had it before, I hope it's enough for you to get something out of it. 7.1 will be an overview. And I'm going to concentrate on scalar fields. It's my opinion that scalar fields carry 97% of all the information you need to know about quantum field theory, because they represent all the kind of problems. They just don't have extra indices, and of course fermions constitute their own kind of problems, but it's not an order of magnitude more complicated. So we're going to concentrate on scalar fields. It'll be useful to illustrate the principal ideas we've been trying to talk about. So let's start with classical theory. I'm going to be focusing on relativistic theories. Again, 94% of the books written on quantum field theory devote themselves to relativistic quantum field theory, so that's a common topic. But again, that's nothing particular, that's just a special kinematics. I'll assume you know something a little bit about relativity. We're going to use a metric in a space which is +1, -1, -1, -1. And I'm going to put on -1, -1, -1, because I'm going to be dealing with n-dimensional space-time. N-dimensional space-time. Of course, one of those dimensions refers to the time. The others refer to the space. So n-1 belongs to the spatial components. When I write partial derivative with respect to index mu squared, what I'm really implying is g mu nu partial mu phi partial nu phi, and that will be equivalent to phi dot squared minus gradient phi quantity squared. Units in which the velocity of light is 1 and h bar equals 1 are customary and common in quantum field theory, and you should not have a major effort in adapting to such units. So I will probably try to use such units. We start with a Lagrangian for a classical field, 1/2
partial mu phi quantity squared minus m squared phi squared, that's a massive term for the particle, minus, and I'll be focusing a great deal of my attention on the quartic coupling. So that will be phi to the fourth theory. When I put all that together and integrate it over my n-dimensional space time, I have created the classical action. Now, I would like to save the symbol phi for my operator. And we're only going to talk about a panel and a half about the classical theory. So I'm going to put a little CL down here to say that we're talking about the classical field. Later, shortly, very quickly actually, the phi symbol will refer to the operator. I vary the I to get the classical equations of motion. Those classical equations of motion will read box plus m squared phi plus 4 lambda phi, box phi, plus 4 lambda phi cubed equals 0. And of course, more precisely, this is phi depending on the space-time point phi of x, m squared phi at the point x, plus 4 lambda phi cubed at the point x equals 0. And of course, all of these belong to the CL field, the classical field. That becomes the classical equation of motion. And you should know that theorems exist for any space-time dimension that tell you that solutions to classical equations exist, provided, of course, lambda, the coupling constant, is either greater than or equal to 0.
Somebody is... Question somebody? Okay.
And they are well-behaved, and they are global solutions for smooth initial data. As a Cauchy problem, we would give the initial field values phi classical at time 0, so I'll write that as x at 0, and the time derivative at time 0, so that's phi classical at x at 0. So this would be the initial data on an initial t equals 0 surface, and then that would be enough to define the theory uniquely throughout space. Okay. Bye-bye to classical theory. Basic quantum theory. So I'm going to underline the classical theory. Basic quantum theory. We'll break up, just as we've done here, our space-time point into its spatial part and its temporal part. And there is, these are now operators, and phi dot for this will come to, gets another name, that's called pi, and that's pi at an x point and a t point. So one could imagine starting with this kinematical problem of choosing a field and a momentum operator which have the following commutation properties, absolutely analogs of the Heisenberg commutation property we have frequently used between capital Q and capital P. Notice I have separated the points, spatial points, x and y, as different, but the temporal points are, I take as the same. And then it's I times H bar, which I'm not writing, times a Dirac delta function of X minus Y times the identity operator, which I am again also not writing. So this is the basic kinematical commutation relation. There's a vast difference between quantum field theory and quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics could be QP is I times the identity operator. Or if I have several degrees of freedom, J sub K delta JK, where the J and the K run between 1 and capital N, where I now insist that N is a finite number. So that would be a finitely many quantum kinematical variables, perfectly analogous to this. What is the great difference between them? For quantum mechanics, there is one and only one irreducible representation of the, well, okay, let's do it that way, of the canonical operators. Up to unitary equivalence. Doesn't matter whether I represent it by in a matrix form or in a form of multiplication by functions, by Q, by X's and derivatives with respect to that X. Unfortunately, however, in quantum field theory, which occurs when this N becomes infinity, there are uncountably many distinct, unitarily inequivalent, irreducible representations of the canonical operators. There is a crude analogy to this situation for the rotation group. The rotation group in three dimensions, you know, and we've talked about it briefly already, has, that's the group which is J, L, J, K, Epsilon J K, no, K L M J M, 1, 2, 3. There are inequivalent representations here, and they are labeled by the so-called spin values, which I'll call little J, which is 0, 1/2, 1, 3/2, etc., in units where H bar is unity. These are inequivalent. And you might come to your quantum mechanical problem and say, I have a spin problem and I have to choose between these representations. These would be the irreducible ones. I may want to combine several of these to make a reducible one, for example. And you have that option to do, and you must choose the right representation. It's not that you can make a unitary transformation to take you between spin a half and spin 3/2, that's impossible. They are distinct and unitarily inequivalent, so you must choose the right representation to work with. Well, the same thing happens in quantum field theory, where you have uncountably many inequivalent representations. And if you choose the wrong representation, you will not get the right answer. And so this is one of the great problems that lives in the quantum field theory and distinguishes it in mathematical complexity from ordinary quantum mechanics. Okay. The next thing I want to talk about in the quantum field theory is the existence of the Hamiltonian.
Newtonian operator. H, script H as we've always called it. This is the fourth element of a vector in a relativistic theory in four dimensions. It's the time component of the momentum vector, I guess we call it. And it has several important properties. One, it should have a non-negative spectrum. It should have a ground state, which is called O. And O should be unique, apart from simple phase changes, for example. Indeed, in the kind of model problems we're dealing with here, where our kinetic energy here is a phi dot squared, right here, 1/2 phi dot squared, and our momentum, where did it rewrite it? Momentum and phi dot are the same, then we actually don't need to specify the momentum operator independently. We can define the momentum operator by means of the commutator between the Hamiltonian and the field operator. So all we need to do is really start with a satisfactory self-adjoint Hamiltonian operator and the field operator, say at time zero, if we like. This works for any particular time. And that will give us the momentum operator at time zero. Indeed, as the self-adjoint operator, this H generates unitary transformations. And so I can use that to relate the field operator at one moment of time to the field operator at another moment of time. So here again, the Hamiltonian operator takes the information about the field operator at time zero and gives you the field at a later time. Take the time derivative of this expression and you will have the conjugate variable of the momentum. Indeed, we can take a time derivative of this equation. I commute a commutator of H with phi time derivative. Gives me the time derivative over here, which is then phi double dot. And this will give me the equation of motion for the so-called Heisenberg operator. And let me just write down what that equation of motion would look like for our model problem. We will have phi double dot x and t minus radian squared or Laplacian and phi x and t plus m squared phi of x and t plus 4 lambda phi cubed of x and t equal to 0. So these are now operators. And I assure you that cubing a local operator is a very delicate operation and a great deal of mathematical problems arise here. So this is mathematically a challenging situation. And we will briefly touch on that as well. Okay. Now, unlike quantum mechanics, quantum field theory does not focus on the Schrödinger equation. That doesn't mean you can't write the Schrödinger equation, you can, but it is less fundamental, let me put it that way. People are keenly interested in what happens when things act on the ground state. And so, for example, you will build up Let me use the abbreviation x by itself for a for the spatial and the time part. So that's x1, phi of x2. We talk about various k here, various field powers acting on the ground state. This gives you various vectors in the Hilbert space you want to deal with. Now, field at the point x is, strictly speaking, a distribution value operator. The other way around, operator value distribution, operator value distribution, which means, strictly speaking, you should integrate it against a nice smooth function in order to have it give proper meaning as an operator. The fact that that's the case would cause difficulty then in talking about the cubes, just like the cube of any distribution can be a delicate matter. Was there a question that I didn't catch?
Okay.
So let's turn to the path integral. Which more properly, since we're dealing with a quantum field theory, is called a functional integral. So I'll put the top one in parentheses this time. And I'll illustrate two examples for you. One close to our propagator language. In the propagator language, as we did before, we often went from sharp position x prime to x double prime, and that particular formal vector was an eigenvector of the Heisenberg coordinate operator. We're interested in eigenvectors now of the field operator at some particular time. So we'll freeze t equal to zero. This is so-called Schrodinger picture, rather. And I put in phi prime as a C number now. This is a C number field. And here is the same ket over here. And here is that C number field evaluated at the point x. So this is the operator statement over here. This is eigenvalue for that particular operator. It's like we've diagonalized the field operator. And if we do that, then we're enabled to ask for the matrix element of the evolution operator, as we have done in our simple quantum mechanical cases. This would be the analog of the propagator. It has a formal path integral representation. In which the action involves exactly the classical action we wrote before. Now, again, on this side of the equation, the phi stands for a C number field. I won't write the symbol classical underneath that. You'll have to understand that for that being on the right-hand side of the field. I left this space here because we are doing it so that at time equal to zero, we are equal to our particular initial field configuration, and at time equal to capital T, our field should equal the final field configuration. And that is an equality that stretches back over the back blackboard down to here. People don't focus on this, so not so popular, let me put it that way, as in contrast to our efforts in focusing on that in quantum mechanics. And what do people use instead? Instead, we introduce an external source. I need some handle on the integral. I need something for which to depend on. If I integrated from some particular value here to some particular value and never was able to vary those, then that would be one number and I'd be done. I need to vary these in order to get some dependence on what that integral has involved. So I will use an integral of the following form. I'm going to introduce one extra term in this term. It's going to be J, which is a C number, times the field phi, which we're integrating. And then I'll have everything else as before, 1/2 relativistic squared derivative minus m squared phi squared minus lambda phi to the fourth. I'll make that a curly bracket, sorry. dnx d phi. And I'm going to integrate this over all space-time. So this is over r to the n. All my fields run over all r to the n, if you like. What do they do at infinity? Well, they fall off. Let's pretend they fall off. There's some normalization here, and I'm going to call that thing capital Z, and it will depend on something. It will depend on this field. So there is a functional of J. And what does it represent? We saw what the propagator represented. The propagator represents the temporal evolvement of this particular state and how much that time evolvement then would look like the state of that same kind. Well, what does this particular integral we've introduced here represent? That's equal to the ground state expectation value of e to the I integral j of x phi. Well, let's do it this way. J of x comma t phi of x and 0. I'm in the Schrodinger picture, so my field, my operators are constant, minus Hamiltonian density. And then I integrate that against dnx over space then and over time. I close that with the vacuum as well, and I must put in the time-ordered product for that integral. So this integral, if you like, then this integral is really over R n. So that's what that represents. Why is that good to me? Well, you remember when we introduced many lectures ago the concept of a functional derivative. If I take a functional derivative on Z, then I can bring down the introduction of the phi inside. So I can begin to take moments of those operators in here, the kind of things which I said over here, which were of basic interest in the quantum field theory. This is a quantity of, then, this is a way, how we're using the handle that we have, the J, in order to create things. So brings field operator to, if that's the exponent, what do we call that line? Baseline?
Prefactor.
To a prefactor, as a prefactor. A construct in formation here could probably be said better. Okay. Now, the solution of this equation, the solution of that integral, the evaluation of that integral is worth your weight in gold. Question?
Okay. The top line.
Top line here.
Yeah. Those phis in the integral, those are C numbers?
Yes.
Down here in the Z?
These are all C numbers.
All C numbers. So now I do the functional derivative.
Right.
And the phi comes down in the...
That would bring a phi down in here as a C number. Over here, it would bring it down as an operator.
So maybe I should put little hats on these guys to make them operate.
Oh, so in that integral, they're not C numbers.
Absolutely not.
These are operators. These are operators, and the hat will help us keep that distinct. These are all C numbers.
That's the consequence of going to that.
Well, same thing over here. Propagator here. If I had a field operator here and I took a derivative. Yeah, right.
And the J is still a regular function.
J is a regular function, and typically J is a smooth function. One would like to think it's smooth, and there's no reason. It's like a test function. It's yours to choose. I told you over here that the field operator makes better sense if I integrate it with a smooth function, and that G is rather like the J in question. Unfortunately, on the other hand, since I've also told you that the operators are really operator value distributions, then the C numbers that we have in here are rather ill-behaved. Now, we're not in a position yet to talk about the measure, or even that this thing is an integral. This is just a linear functional. So it's premature to tell you what the nature of the functions are in this functional integral. But they are distribution valued at the best. Okay. So that's what we would like to be able to do. I'm going to turn my attention at this point to the free field, which will be section 7.2. Lambda is identically zero, so we do not have the quartic interaction. Things are much easier to deal with. We can actually calculate and compute things. And then after we have some experience with that, we're going to go back and talk about how we introduce the quartic interaction. Okay. So our goal is to study the following kind of integral, e to the I, j phi, plus 1/2 partial mu phi squared minus m squared phi, dnx, curly d phi, script n equals z. I'll put a subscript down there as c sub 0. To remind us, we're talking about the free system, where lambda equals zero. Beg your pardon, phi squared. You're right. Thank you. Okay, now this integral, as was the previous one, is poorly defined, ill-defined, but I can do at least one thing to try to help it. And I'll show you what that is right now. I'm going to add in one little term, partial mu phi squared minus m squared minus I epsilon phi squared. So I am arbitrarily giving the mass, mass squared, a little extra imaginary part. So it's m squared minus I epsilon, and then taking the limit as epsilon goes to zero at the final step. Why am I doing that? That minus I epsilon, watch it here. That's a plus together with that minus, so that's really a plus I epsilon that belongs with that term. Plus I epsilon times that I give me a minus epsilon phi squared. So everything else is a phase factor except this one term, which is a minus epsilon. E to the I phase, and then a minus epsilon integral phi squared over 2, by the way, dnx. That's a damping term. That makes the integral absolutely convergent. So the difficulty about the non-existence of the integral at least disappears in one small way. by having this absolute integrability introduced. Now notice, if I change the sign of that, if I put in a plus epsilon here, then I would have a plus here, and the integrals would simply not exist. This would make them worse. So that sign is dictated, the term is dictated by ensuring the existence of the integral. So this epsilon factor dictated by mathematical convergence. You don't have much choice then. You don't use another sign, because that will just get you into real trouble. Okay. Well, this is a quadratic problem. Quadratic integral. I haven't said it, I should have said it, that's unfortunate, that I arrange this normalization so that z evaluated at zero external source is normalized to be unity. That's going to be actually transparent from this equation. If the j is zero, then all I've got is the integral of the Hamiltonian density, which gives me the Hamiltonian. But the Hamiltonian is seeing an eigenvector with eigenvalue zero. So that gives me zero up in the exponent, which is a unity. Zero with zero is normalized, I get number one. So I want to do that here as well. Z sub zero at zero j is to be identified as one. Quadratic integral. Well, what's the story? Well, to evaluate the exponent that comes from the extremal solution. So let's take our extremal of this action. That means I find the equation of motion would come from there. Well, here I'll vary the phi, I get j, I get minus box, I will now define box for you, which I failed to do over there, minus m squared phi, minus I epsilon. Now I'm going to keep the little I epsilon, which is part of that, equals zero. That's my equation I get for my extremal solution.
John, I've got an I problem here. Can you read the lines to me above the equation?
Quadratic integral.
Yeah. No. What's the next line?
Yep. Exponent of our answer comes from the extremal solution. So I'm going to put a little ext down here just to remind ourselves that that is the extremal function. So how do we do that? Well, that's j, let's do it the other way around, box plus m squared minus I epsilon phi equals j extremal. Oh, by the way, box, what is box? Box is d2 by dt squared. Of course, there would be a c squared here, which is now set equal to 1, minus d2 by dx j squared, the spatial part summed on the j. So that's the Dalet-Bershon generalized to n dimensions. Okay, so phi extremal of x is 1 over box plus m squared minus I epsilon acting on j of x. I'm going to write that the following way, same denominator, but then I'm going to write, letting it act on the function delta of x minus y, j of y, dn of y. That's just another way to write j of x. So that is phi extremal over box plus m squared minus I epsilon
for the delta function, I now insert its integral representation, e to the I k dot x minus y dnk j of y dny. This box now, the derivatives, c eigenfunctions. By the way, that box is in the variable x, the space and time parts of this first variable x. So the derivatives will bring down an ik, and the square of that will be a minus ik squared. I'll bring that inside the integral, of course, 1 over 2 pi to the power n. I change the sign of things, just to be mean, minus m squared minus I epsilon e to the I k dot x minus y dnk k j of y dny. So here we have an integral kernel. We call it delta f x minus y j of y dny phi external of x. That is the famous Feynman propagator associated with a scalar field in this box, the way I've written it. The Feynman propagator has an I epsilon in it as a device to avoid a pole in the integration. If that epsilon was not there, there would be ambiguity in the vanishing of the denominator. And I have read Feynman's original thesis. I have no proof of this statement, but it is my opinion that he came upon his I epsilon prescription from the path integral by observing that is the only thing he could put in to assist the convergence. If you put in some other way to help the convergence, well, there is no other way to help the convergence. Any other term you put in there would violate the convergence. So rather than physical arguments which he gave later, when he didn't introduce the path integral as a way to use, to develop the Feynman function, it's my judgment that he may have come across it first by observing that this was a small change that made things converge, and it turns out to be the correct method. Okay, with your permission, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to stop a few minutes early. I'm asking Tommy Hughes to pass out the student evaluation forms.